First, and probably the most vexing, is this is 6 in the morning California time. And I'm not sure what the polite way of saying this is, but I'm not a morning person. So my response time is going to be, well, slower than usual, I guess is the right way to put it. The second problem that I foresee is that I gave a course on related topics at Stanford last fall, where I gave of order 25 hours of lectures covering, well, the topics I want to cover, plus a few more. And I'm going to try to talk for an hour and a half today. So, I don't know, in a quantum information conference, I guess we should talk about a certain amount of data compression. I don't know many of these algorithms. The algorithms that I do know are the most brutal kinds of compression, which are truncation, packet dropping. And so I think we'll get as far as we get. And I hope to get to a couple of the high points in this topic. But there will be a lot I won't be able to say. I'm going to aim for non-experts. I'm not going to talk about technical details. Fortunately, there are papers that explain the technical details in a relatively clear way, I think. And I've listed a few of the ones that I think are relatively clear. There's an annoying typo in this paper in equation 26. Aside from that, I think the paper, although maybe not written in flowing prose, is correct. So to consult, I will not hesitate to refer you to the papers for any technical points. This will also refer to this other question about response time that I alluded to earlier. Okay, I think that's the list of the problems that I foresee. I'm sure others will come up. But with that set of caveats, let me start talking about the topic that I want to explore. The topic is the interconnections between quantum chaos and quantum gravity. That these two topics should be connected, I think, goes back to at least to the early 70s, when through the work of Bekenstein and Hawking, we appreciated that black holes are thermal objects. It's been known since the work of Boltzmann, I guess, that thermal behavior in standard non-gravitational systems is closely related to the chaos in those systems. So if black holes are thermal systems, it's not unlikely that there's some chaos in their dynamics. This connection became essentially a certainty with the advent of gauge gravity duality that related the dynamics of at least certain large black holes, larger than an AdS scale, to the thermal equilibrium dynamics of a non-gravitational boundary system, often the quantum field theory. Since we are quite certain that the behavior of that non-gravitational system, its thermal behavior, is driven by strong chaos, there must be a dual image of that chaos in the bulk gravity. That's what we want to talk about today. One of the early aspects of that connection is the fact that that one of the consequences of chaos is we believe that if you perturb a quantum system, a thermal system, ping it, it rapidly relaxes to equilibrium. The bulk image of that was first discussed by Horowitz and Kubeny. If you ping a black hole, it rapidly rings down via quasi-normal modes to its original quiescent state. And those quasi-normal modes are the analog of relaxation rates in the quantum thermal system. Today, I want to explore a related but distinct aspect of chaos and its image in black holes. Now, as one gets older, and I'm afraid I'm in that along that trajectory, the line of development, the intellectual line of development of ideas becomes important because you want to see, well, the sociology of how things develop. The line of development I want to describe actually originated in a paper of Patrick Hayden and John Preskill, both of whom I guess are here in the front row, that connected the dynamics of black holes, black hole horizons, to work on the fast approximations of random unitaries that came in from completely different reasons in the world of quantum information. A paper that was especially important is one by Denker, Cleave, Emerson, and Levine, and that work I think was done here, or at least at the University of Waterloo. So this is a Waterloo kind of subject. In particular, they related a time scale that's characteristic in black holes, the logarithm of the Schwarzschild radius over a short distance, the length of a stretched horizon, which is often taken to be L Planck, to the time it takes to diffuse information across of n qubits, which you might think of as the log of the entropy of the system of n qubits. Okay. And this connection is going to be at the center of what we'll talk about today. A lot of what we'll try to do is make this connection precise. This connection was further developed by Sacchino and Susskind, who made the connection of these ideas to gauge gravity duality and formulated the fast scrambling conjecture, basically that this is the fastest rate you expect information to be scrambled up in any reasonable physical system. We'll talk more about that later. These kinds of discussions of scrambling and subsequent ones were often phrased in the language of quantum information. You use quantum information theoretic probes. The purities of subsystems, and so on. You perturb a state, and you wait and see how long it is before the density matrix of a subsystem essentially looks maximally mixed. In contrast, we will talk about probes that are better suited in some ways to quantum field theory, things like correlation functions and other more familiar objects, well, more familiar objects before 10 years ago, say, in the subject of quantum field theory. And having these probes will turn out to let us apply rather powerful techniques, both of holography and conventional quantum field theory, to analyze the situation and allow us to make very precise statements about what's going on. Now, the connection between these information theoretic probes and the, if you will, the quantum field theoretic correlation function probes has recently been greatly clarified in a paper by Ozer, Shi, Roberts, and Yoshida that unfortunately I won't have time to talk about. But until recently, a large number of those people were here. And so you might have a chance of finding them and talking about it. Otherwise, I suggest that you look at that paper to see the connection. I'm going to focus on these more field theoretic correlation function probes. I'll try, although it'll be unclear, to use the word scrambling when I refer to the quantum information theoretic probes of this phenomenon, and chaos when I refer to the quantum field theoretic, more traditional probes, if you will. But of course, we're talking about different aspects of the same phenomenon. So let's begin talking about the ideas that we want to formalize. We want to find the quantum analogy to the important classical notion, the classical chaotic notion of sensitive dependence on initial conditions. Sensitive dependence on initial conditions, which is the hallmark of what's often called strong chaos, which is the thing that underlies thermal behavior. This is often called colloquially the butterfly effect. A butterfly flaps its wings somewhere and it causes a hurricane somewhere halfway across the globe. Things are very unstable. You could draw a picture where in a classical phase space, a trajectory evolves, you perturb it a little bit, and then you run backwards in time. And rather than going back to where you came, you actually end up at quite a different place. The quantum version of this statement turns out to be, you imagine evolving forward in time by e to the minus iht, apply some operator, the Schrodinger operator, and then evolve backward in time, and ask, what operator do you get at the result? Is it very different than this operator W? If it is, in some sense, the system is chaotic. Time evolution is very sensitive to the presence of this perturbation. If this perturbation weren't here, either the iht would cancel out exactly, and you just get the identity operator. But if this operator W, even if it's small and the evolution is chaotic, you get something very different there. So we're led to examine the operator e to the minus iht, W e to the plus iht. This is sometimes called W of t, the Heisenberg operator. But often it's useful for us to think about this as a string of three Schrodinger operators. But of course, it's the same thing. In the field, this is sometimes called an example of a precursor operator. Okay. So in chaotic systems, we expect this operator, especially for large time, to be very different than the operator W itself. And so we'll want to diagnose the nature of this operator. The operator grows in some sense we'll talk about as a function of time. This is explained very clearly in this paper by Roberts. I guess it's Douglas Stanford, not me. Stanford and Susskind. Called localized shocks. I recommend you look at that. It's maybe the clearest exposition I know of this intuition. Roughly the idea is the following. Let's imagine that you have a boson creation and annihilation operators, and you have a Hamiltonian that looks like A dagger A and psi 1, some chain of free bosons. And you want to study the time evolution of A sub J. J is a particular site. This might be a one-dimensional chain. This is W. And then W of T, you can do an expansion of e to the iht, e to the minus iht, using Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff. And you write this as AJ plus commutator of H of AJ. I'm leaving out all minus signs and factors of anything other than what I care about. And you can see that the commutator of H with AJ, you hit just a creation and you just get something like AJ plus 1. Here you might get AJ plus 2 or something. The only thing that happens when you evolve in time in a situation like this is the operator AJ moves. Moving isn't a very big deal. And so this is an example of a non-chaotic system. And in fact, the system is iterable. It has an infinite number of conservation laws, the number of bosons in every mode. But suppose you added some four these are, I guess, what, I plus 2, I plus 2, some kind of four boson coupling, then you'd see that this term would have three A's, and this term might have five A's, and there's some way that the operator gets bigger as you evolve in time. The operator grows colloquially in the sense that the number of A's increases in time. And it's that growing phenomena that is the hallmark of chaos. Now, it could be, if you specially arrange things, that this Hamiltonian is, in fact, integral for secret reasons. But this growing is a necessary part of the establishment of quantum chaos. Now, we'll be especially interested in non-local systems today. And the paradigm with a system that the kind of thing that Hayden and Preskill first discussed is a sum. You have n, let's say, Paulis that have no special locality relations, and with some coupling constants, jij, and these are beta runs for over x, y, and z, and j's could be random or some other choice. And then if you imagine your operator w is some sigma x at site l, is that what I chose? Sigma k. Then under Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff, you might get something with two sigmas plus three sigmas, and so on. They're not locally, they just come from anywhere in the set of n. But the interactions are pairwise. And so the interaction, again, the operator grows. It's important that you only have a certain finite number of sigmas coupled together. And such systems are called k-local. So this is a two-local Hamiltonian. If you had three sigmas, it would be three-local. And in general, k-local, where k is finite, doesn't grow with n. If every spin coupled to every other, the operator in one step would grow as big as possible. So the growth process would happen as quickly as it could. Well, we want to diagnose sort of how bad, this is W of T, this growth is. It's not bad, it's good. How much growth it has. And for here, we use a diagnostic that was introduced into this subject in the world of black holes by the AMPS collaboration, Elmeri, Marolf, Polchinski, Sully, and Stanford. You write W of T formally as a sum of strings of sigmas. And you ask, given one sigma sub L, sort of how many of these strings contain that one particular qubit? Well, you might start with sigma at k, x. And this process, you generate strings of sigmas, and lots of strings. There are lots of different ways of getting to sigma l. Okay, I don't mean in local distance, but just hopping around this set of n sites. And the number of strings can grow exponentially with time evolution. This is very much in the spirit of Lieb Robinson bounds. It's kind of like people have used the analogy of an infection process. You ask if you have a population, and this spin in one time step infects another and so on. This infection process, as you know, infections can grow exponentially. Patient zero can infect patient one, who can, you know the way it goes, okay? So it's not implausible that the number of things with this particular thing in it grows exponentially. And the sharp diagnostic of that, how do you figure out if a certain sigma L is in one of these operators? You take its commutator. This may not be optimal. And so a way of diagnosing sort of how many of these strings contain is to take the commutator of sigma L, the target, with sigma K, where you started. Every time sigma L occurs in the string, the commutator will click. And the commutator is an operator. You want to ask how big is that operator. Now, in qubit systems, there are lots of ways of asking how big the commutator is as an operator. You could use some operator norm. This is what Lieb and Robinson talk about. We're interested in applying this notion to things like quantum field theories, the boundary theory in ADS-CFT, for instance, where operators are unbounded, and especially if you look at high-energy states, you have more and more field theory quanta. These norms can easily get infinite, and that infinity is not of interest. Okay? UV kinds of things you want to take out of the system. So this is not the measure we'll use. In fact, the measure we'll use is, I think, the way Dan Roberts and Brian Swingle talked about it, it's a kind of a regulated operator norm, a regulated Lieb-Robinson quantity. We'll be interested in the quantity commutator that's equal to the thermal expectation value of minus the commutator of sigma L, sigma K, T squared. If these things are Hermitian, the commutator is anti-Hermitian, it's square, with a negative sign will be positive, thermal expectation value. And if the temperature is infinite, if beta equals zero, this is some kind of operator norm. But if these operators are unbounded, this says don't look at any quanta with energies greater than the thermal energy. Just don't look at those UV quanta in the system. Yeah, you could, but I'm not doing it. I'm studying this. And what we expect, if we normalize this Hamiltonian so that when n goes to infinity, we have a good large n limit. I'll leave it as an exercise about how to do that. What that really means is I had a little trouble getting the factors right last night. Okay. So that's an exercise. This goes like 1 over n exponentially in time. We'll call that exponent lambda sub L. We'll talk more about this exponent. Lambda would be the usual choice in chaos. Lambda is permanently reserved in any subject involving gauge gravity duality for the Atuft coupling. So I have to distinguish it from the Atuft coupling. I'm putting in L. I'll tell you what the L refers to in just a bit. Okay. And this kind of relation will be the subject of a lot of what we're going to talk about today. Well, you might ask, to get started, when does this commutator get to be about 1? This commutator squared? Well, it gets 1 at a time t star, where lambda L t star 1 over m. When this is about 1, that is t star is about 1 over lambda L log n. That's kind of that log entropy time that we talked about. So this exponential growth is related to this logarithmic time scale. Okay. There's no distance. It's completely non-local graph. Okay. This particular system is completely non-local, but only a finite number of points connects to any other point. Okay. The local situation, there are additional things that happen. But for now, let's just talk about a non-local situation. Yeah, L and K are anything. They just are two things picked out of this non-local system. The crucial thing is there's this property of K locality that in the Hamiltonian, only a finite number of sigmas are coupled together in each term. Okay, so that's the one constraint on this non-local Hamiltonian. Otherwise, in one step, you could grow the operator as big as you wanted. So it's an infection process with lots of jet travel, where it's very easy to cross continents, and distance doesn't have much to do with the spread of the infection. Okay. This, as all of us know, is kind of a problem. Well, we want to connect this notion and explain the label of this to notions of classical chaos. And the way to do this, although it took us a long time to do this, it took Kateyev to teach us this. The question about how to diagnose quantum chaos, a sensible thing to do would be to do semi-classical chaos, a small deviation from classical chaos. This actually was done in the 60s by two Russian physicists, Larkin and Ovchinnikov, who said the following thing. They said, classically, you might imagine, again, in a classical phase space, you have two points at position q of 0 and q of 0 plus delta q of 0. That's some positions. And you evolve in time, and delta q of 0 evolves to delta q of t in an unstable, highly chaotic system. The norm of delta q of t grows exponentially in time, where this exponent is called a Lyapunov exponent. That's the diagnostic of hyperbolic dynamical behavior, the strongest kind of chaos, and the one that we're quite confident can be responsible for thermal behavior. If you imagine the collisions of two classical atoms, if they're a little bit like this, they go off that way. The positions change, they might go off that way. Very sensitive to the exact input parameters about where they end up after a couple of collisions. Now, suppose the first thing is you can diagnose this effect by asking what's the derivative of q of t with respect to q at position 0. But in classical Hamiltonian mechanics, you can write this as the Poisson bracket of q of t, the momentum operator at time 0. Here I'm being a bit schematic, where this is the Poisson bracket. But once you have things expressed in Poisson brackets, you can quantize semi-classically. And you can say the Poisson bracket should go over, under semi-classical quantization, to 1 over I h bar, the commutator of the operator q of t, hat means quantum operator, p of 0. So again, we see commutators emerging. Okay. And so this commutator squared, you have the I taken care of by the minus sign, will go like C of t will go like h bar squared e to the 2 lambda lt. OK, this 2 is mightily irritating. This turns out to happen in certain semi-classical contexts. It actually happens in Einstein gravity for reasons I won't explain. This is a subtlety that I won't emphasize. But roughly speaking, the commutator squared, sometimes there's a 2 and sometimes there's a 1. Of which side? This one? It's basically this. Express your question. Ask your question again. Of this, yes. I'm not sure other than re-expressing it this way. Okay. There may well be a way of expressing it. I'm not sure how to take derivatives of quantum operators with respect to each other. There probably is a more sophisticated way of doing it. The thing that you don't want to do, and the mistake all of us make, is to say in quantum mechanics you should ask how two nearby quantum states evolve in time. You might say two nearby quantum states should get further apart under time evolution. Okay. This is a mistake. Under unitary time evolution, the distance between states never changes. That's what unitary time evolution. So that's the wrong notion. Okay. This turns out to be the right notion. Okay. This analogy is a little bit imperfect in a number of ways. One imperfection in the analogy is that this coefficient here, 1 over n, is like 1 over the entropy of a qubit system. The entropy in a semi-classical system is the log of the dimension of phase space, or the number is, which is roughly log of a linear dimension in phase space to the dimension of phase space power divided by h bar to the d over 2. Well, that's the, so this goes like 1 over h, log of 1 over h bar. So the entropy goes like log of 1 over h bar, not h bar. So this coefficient is something like 1 over e to the entropy. Okay. So the parallels are imperfect. Okay. But it still is suggestive, and many of us, but not all of us, use the imprecision of notation and call this and this a Lyapunov exponent. Some purists refer to the quantum version as a chaos exponent. Okay. But that L stands for Lyapunov. But we see that we have good reason to focus on these commutators as a diagnostic of the way of the problems in going backwards and forwards in quantum mechanics and subject to small perturbations. And in fact, what we expect if we plotted the commutator, this function C of t, the thermal expectation value of a commutator squared, it should start off essentially zero. And then it should rapidly build up exponentially. And then it turns out what happens is it sort of saturates when the operator has covered all the bit qubits there are. We'll talk about the saturation later. And this is the kind of curve we're going to want to explain in a variety of different ways. And this time here is this T star, which is this scrambling time, as it's called. It goes like log n, which is the scrambling. I'll tell you the various timescales and so on in a minute. Let's pull apart the commutator. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
For this commutator to change,
yes.
Does that mean that
many paths will yes. Yeah. Yeah. And sort of if you think of doing Lieb Robinson, you know, so you have many strings created by, and it's the number of those strings that grows exponentially. So that's the origin of the Lieb Robinson bound, which is the source of this exponential. Yes. And you're asking about whether there's a 1 over lambda?
Yes.
Yes, I'm eliding that. I should put a 1 over lambda here. So often squiggles mean I've dropped various constants. Okay, but yes. So we've decided to focus on a commutator, and now I'll rewrite it in terms of more general C of t in a more general setup. For instance, quantum field theory will consist of an operator W of t, commutator V at time 0, squared, thermal expectation value. A very important thing is to realize that a commutator squared can be written as the sum of 4 terms. Okay, so let's try to write it out. This is equal to plus V of 0, W of T, V of 0, plus W of T, V of 0, Zero. Minus. I guess I should put this on the next line. Four terms, as promised. These terms behave very differently. So let's talk about the first two, which are the boring ones. Think of T as very large. So in the thermal trace, describing the thermal expectation value, you can think of this term as applying V to the thermal state, to the sum of states that makes the canonical ensemble. Okay, it disrupts the state. It adds like a photon or something to the states. Then those states bounce around and equilibrate. And a million years later, you take the expectation value of W of T in that slightly perturbed thermal state. The system had plenty of time to relax down. And so you're computing the expectation value of W of T, some late time operator in a slightly perturbed thermal state. It's had time to relax to thermal equilibrium, so it's essentially a thermal state again. So this you expect to go over to something that measures the sort of change in the thermal state, change of normalization, to essentially the thermal expectation value again. We'll explain this in a slightly more precise way in a minute, but this is intuitively plausible. So T large. This one will do the same thing in a kind of time-reversed way. First of all, in a thermal situation, thermal states are time-independent. So this is independent of T. So it doesn't matter at what time. It relaxes down to a number, time-independent. This thing might start a little high and then relax and approach a constant value given by this time-independent number. This one will do the same thing by some time-reversed version. Boring. These are the place where stuff happens. Notice that these terms have a peculiar property. This is correlated as written, no time ordering. If T is large, this is late, time early, late, early. It's out of time order. So we can call these, morally speaking, time ordered, and these we'll call out of time order, OTO. These are the ones that code chaos. Okay. And their behavior, which we'll talk about subsequently, is that at early times, these don't do anything different than this. So a picture of one of these is you start early, this is OTO, you start at something like VVWW. And then eventually you come down to zero rather rapidly, and you end up at zero. I'll explain this behavior more as we go along. Then you can see if you add this to this, you get the picture of the commutator as doing this. Almost cancellation between this and this. And then it rises up to 2WWVV, when the only terms that survive are the first two time-ordered things. So it's the vanishing of the OTO correlators, the out-of-time order correlators, that lets the commutator turn on. So we've turned the diagnostic of this growing operator by commutators into the calculation of a certain unusual correlation function, an out-of-time order correlation function. And so much of the rest of what we'll talk about is ways to compute these out-of-time order correlation functions. Yes? Yes.
So that feature happens at order 1/10?
Something like that, yeah. It can depend a little bit on the kind of operators, but unless something's peculiar, it's like that. And I'm assuming a relatively strongly coupled system, so there's no small coupling constants in the system. The gravity dual would be the quasi-normal mode rate of a dual. Now, a useful set of pictures to understand these different things is to introduce the concept of a time fold, which was introduced in this subject by Rolf Polchinski, Sully, Himsker. And so the pictures that make it useful to draw is to represent these thermal expectation values by a picture that looks like that. This is the Euclidean thermal circle. That's, of course, what a thermal expectation value is. And let's say we're going to draw a picture of this one. This is beta running from 0 to 2 pi. Minkowski time will come kind of out of the board. So here's the operator V. It's at Minkowski time 0. Here's W that comes out to time T. Here's W of T. E to the minus IHT, and then it comes back. So this is W. This is time T. This is time evolution by minus T. It comes back. Comes back out again to make a W of T again. And then it joins and puts another V. So V is at time 0. W, you have to evolve forward in Minkowski time, backward in Minkowski time. Think of these coming out of the board. I apologize for my drafting. This is a three-dimensional picture. The disk is living in the board. These things are coming out of the board. Yes, the disk represents the thermal trace. Okay, this is in Euclidean time. This is Minkowski time coming out of the cylinder. So this is Euclidean time, here's Minkowski time. And these things are moving like this. Okay. And there's a lot of operators going on here, this forward and backward. But the point is, for these guys, this forward evolution can cancel against this, this backward evolution can cancel against this forward evolution. So these operator strings cancel, and this goes to the simpler picture. WWVV. And then you can imagine, let's say, these operators are close together compared to this very long time. You can do a kind of operator product. You can write this as a sum of local operators at late time. These Vs can be written as a sum of local operators. And you see, no, this is the first, this is just the first term. I'll draw one of the OTO ones in a minute. So you do some kind of operator product, and you see basically things with a thermal one-point function are the only thing that survives, and you get the sum of thermal one-point functions here and here. That's the part that survives at long distance, and that gives this decoupled behavior. And the crucial thing is both of these W's are at late time. There's no intervening fold because it canceled. Now let's draw the picture for one of the OTO ones. Let's draw two. This is star one. This is star two. Here's a picture of star two. Again, you have a thermal circle. You have a V. You come out, you put a W there, and you come back. But now you have a V intervening. This V intervening prevents the cancellation of this backwards time with this forward time. These don't cancel. Essentially by chaos, this V sets off a difference between this and this. It makes the operator grow. And so you can imagine in this overlap, well, this thing is a very different operator than this thing. This thing has grown in size a lot because you don't have these cancellations of time evolution. So the expectation value of a big complicated operator with a little operator is going to be small. And that's another way of understanding that this expectation value goes to zero as time goes to infinity. The lack of cancellation means that you have this growing operator present in the expectation value. This cancellation means that there's no big operators you have to worry about. Okay, so these out-of-time order correlators are the things that are diagnosing this growing operator. And this fits with the fact that they're the things that diagnose chaos. These pictures are very useful to see, do you have an operator that diagnoses chaos or not? You look for non-canceling time folds. For instance, here's another example that we'll use later that also diagnoses non-canceling time folds or has non-canceling time folds. Can people see this low, or should I go up higher? Should I go higher? Okay, down here? Okay. So you can imagine analytically continuing V by half a period in Euclidean time. So you can imagine a closely related operator where you keep, this is not an operator here, this is just joining on. Where you join on, you go like this. You have V, W. But instead of putting the V here, you bring it around half a circle. You know when you do that, you go to the other side of the thermal field double state, which is a purification of the thermal expectation value. So you have a V on the left, on the right-hand side, a V on the left-hand side, and then this W still on the right-hand side. And so you have this kind of two-sided correlator in the thermofield double state, but it still has non-canceling time folds. So this will diagnose chaos just as well. This is, in fact, the first thing that Douglas and I looked at, and it's something that's very easy to geometrize. And so I'll talk a little bit about it later. Okay? But this will, for the same reasons, will diagnose chaos. Non-canceling time folds diagnoses chaos. Canceling time folds does not. That's the rule of thumb. The next step, and this is where I joined the story, is to use precise techniques to calculate such things. Okay? One powerful set of techniques we have are holographic techniques. So what we'd like to do now, we have this precise diagnostic, we should be able to give a precise gravitational way of computing these things, which will then give us the gravitational analog of chaotic development in the boundary field theory. So let's imagine we're trying to compute one of these out-of-time order correlators holographically. All right, so let me start this. Have people written this down? Now, I'll leave it for now. It's awkward to write. And here I'm going to follow the treatment quite closely in this paper, which is, I think, the clearest description of the holographic calculation of these out-of-time order correlators. I refer you to that. It's a little dense, but it's extremely clear. And well, this is the go-to reference for what I'm about to say. So So in particular, let's study a correlator at general time. I'll call it D of t. V of t1, W of t2. This correlator is as written, no time ordering. V of t3, W of t4. Thermal expectation value. And think of this as late time. Think of this as early. Think of this as late. And think of this as early. I'm leaving all four time indices open, well, frankly, because this is the notation we followed, and this decreases my error rate at 7 in the morning, wherever we are. Oh, 7 in the morning. I have an hour and a half. Well, the packet dropping has just gotten more impressive. The idea is to write this as the overlap of two quantum states in a suitable Hilbert space, not a thermal expectation value. And the way you do that, as usual, is to write thermal expectation values as using the purification of a thermal density matrix in a thermal field double state. So I know you know about thermal field double states, so I won't write down formulas. So we can write psi prime as equal to V of T3, W of T4 on thermal field double. And psi as the adjoint W of T2 dagger V dagger of T1 on thermal field double. And let's assume we have Hermitian operators, so I will eliminate the daggers. And then taking the overlap produces this in the standard way. And where we're going is I want to interpret that overlap as another place you compute overlaps in the computation of scattering. So, now we try to give a holographic interpretation of this. That is, we do this calculation in a particular quantum system that has a gauge gravity dual. Imagine we're in N equals 4 super Yang-Mills, for instance, or any other system with a good holographic dual. Let's imagine we're in a conformal field theory, so the geometry is pure ADS. So we need pictures for these various quantum objects. Well, as you know, the holographic dual of the thermal field double state is this two-sided eternal black hole. And this is the right-hand copy of the thermal field double, and this is the left. And now I want to be careful. This is a quantum state. This is a space-time picture of the state. So we can really think of this state as living on a certain time slice of this space-time picture. We can use whatever time slicing we want. For now, let's actually think of a time slicing appropriate to the bulk, not the usual one appropriate to, let's say, Schwarzschild. Let's imagine we put in time slices like this. In perturbative quantum gravity, which is all we'll be talking about today, you can imagine doing evolution in bulk, sort of Kruskal time or whatever. It's a highly time-dependent background. You have a singularity here and a singularity here. But if you do things that occur on small scales compared to ADS scales, it doesn't matter. And we'll try to stay away from the singularity so our world doesn't fall apart.
Okay. But when you express something other than that holographic picture, isn't there a preferred time to directly represent?
It's preferred because it's a killing symmetry. It's a killing symmetry. I can compute in whatever time I want. It's only preferred because it's a symmetry. And of course, we'll use that symmetry as much as we can. But it will turn out this other time is the place where the most lucid interpretation comes. The reason that that obvious time, the boundary time, may not be the right one is because we're studying this rather peculiar object that is not time ordered in that time. So now let's actually construct psi prime and psi. Okay? So here is what the construction of psi prime say. I'll proceed step by step, because this is the central thing. So here's, we now want to compute in several steps. Here's applying the operator W of T4 onto thermofield double. Remember T4 is late, so it's up here in boundary time. And you imagine you're creating a little kind of packet of W quanta. W, let's say, is dual to some scalar field in the bulk of mass, I don't know, 2.5 ADS masses. So it's a little quanta. Let's say it's smeared to have like thermal energy. All right. And it's, let's say, it imagine in this kind of time slicing, it lives on this time slice. But the state is a whole thermal history, is a whole time history of that state. What happens when we evolve this back in time, let's say, according to this time slicing? Well, for a packet to get out, let's say, several horizon radii with thermal energy, and you go backward in time by the standard kind of transplanckian issues involving black holes that I know Daniel talked about in one of his lectures, this quanta, as you go early in time, has to start hugging the horizon and get blue shifted to enormous energies down here. So this is the space-time history of that mode. And so we can imagine on this bulk time slice, there's a very high energy mode, very close to the horizon. Okay. Let's say this is time T4, boundary time. Here's time T3. We can now construct V of time T3 on W of time T4. Well, that just injects some thermal scale quanta here. So on this time slice, this is what this ket looks like. But now there's a space-time history of this. Well, here's the space-time history of this slice. It started here with a mode. I probably should have been using colored chalk, but let me not. Very close to the horizon, high energy, and here's a mode here. What happens when you follow this state forward in time? This mode hugs the horizon at very high energy. This mode is pretty close to the horizon and goes forward. But they meet, and somewhere in this state is a collision. And then whatever the collision products are, they continue going like that. This is a state with a collision. It's a scattering state. We want to diagnose this scattering process as a function of this global time. Well, usually if you have a scattering state, this is an in-state. Far in the past, these modes were not coupled. As you iterate it forward, it scatters. We want the analog of an out-state. So now let's diagnose this thing, and it will not surprise you at all to learn that it's going to be an out state. Let's construct it in the same way. So now let's construct the state psi. Well, the first thing we do is we construct V of T1. Remember, T1 is early. So we had to construct V of T1 here. Here's a mode here, evolved forward in time. It starts getting very close to the horizon. On this time slice, it's here. Then we can apply W of T2, which is late, making a mode here. And so this is the picture. If you evolved it back, it would collide backwards in time. So this looks like an out state that is the partner of this in state. So we can write this as out in. for some scattering process proceeding in bulk forward-going time, not the time of the standard Rindler or Schwarzschild time, bulk time. So this thing, this peculiar out-of-time-order correlator, whose time ordering is funny from the point of view of boundary time, is exactly the kind of time order that you'd think about for computing bulk physics. So if you take nothing more away from the lecture, take this away, that chaos, which is diagnosed by this, is dual under gauge gravity duality to what will be a high energy collision near the horizon of a black hole in the bulk. That is the essence of what's going on. So now we need to compute some quantitative aspects of that collision. We'll be interested in things that grow fastest in time, so we want, it will turn out, the kinds of collisions that whose amplitude grows fastest in energy. Out in, you can write as usual for a scattering process, as e to the I times a phase shift. And the phase shift will usually depend on the center of mass energy, usually written as Mandelstam S, and some impact parameter, which we'll ignore for now. We'll imagine that these operators, they may have some position in space, transverse space, but let's ignore that for now. I think I'll erase these pictures. Yes? You can easily imagine them localized in space, but I'm going to ignore that subtlety for right now. Okay, but if you look, for instance, in this paper, we study what happens if they're localized in space. Okay, but we also can imagine them smeared across, let's say, a spatial circle. Both things can be done. Okay, but by ignoring that impact parameter, I'm ignoring that issue for now. Well, if this is some Feynman diagram, if this is, let's say, a V quanta in the bulk, and here's a W quanta, they scatter by exchanging other quanta. This is a bulk picture. The one that grows fastest in energy is if you exchange a graviton. And it's a basic principle of tree-level graviton exchange that this amplitude, the phase shift, goes like G Newton, the gravitational coupling constant, times Mandelstam S, the center of mass energy squared, times things involving the transverse separation, or ADS scale, which I'll suppress for now. So we know this piece. Now we all just have to figure out what S is in terms of these boundary times. The crucial thing is that moving in boundary time, it's a symmetry of this diagram that I assume you've discussed. It's like a boost symmetry. Translating in this time, if you look in the central region where the thing is essentially flat Minkowski space, it's not translation anymore. It's boosting. It's like in Rindler space. Translations in time is translations in rapidity in a boost. Okay? It's an additive symmetry, so T must be the rapidity of the boost. Okay? So energies of a quanta must be proportional to e to the T times some constant, times these original energies. If these operators made some energy that's thermal scale, the original energy might be the temperature. So the energy, let's say, of a W quanta, and it's a basic fact of black hole geometry or Rindler space, the near horizon region, that this coefficient is 2 pi over beta, where beta is the inverse temperature of the black hole. You can remember this by saying, well, everything reasonable has to be periodic in imaginary time. You add T goes to T plus I beta. That changes this by 2 pi I. That's why it's 2 pi over beta. So the energy grows exponentially in this time. That's the essential kinematic fact that we have to add. And so if you imagine the scattering process, where the W quanta is very late at time t, and the V quanta is at time 0, this thing is flying with this enormous energy. The V quanta has just thermal energy. This collision happens near the horizon. The center of mass energy, if these are essentially null, is approximately EV times EW, which is T squared e to the 2 pi T over beta. It grows exponentially in time because of the basic boost character. And this fact was noted in the earliest papers, the Hayden and Presco paper and the Susskind-Sacchino paper, as the origin of this logarithm. It goes back to the days of transplanckian behavior in black holes, the problem that Hawking pointed out. This exponential increase in energies means studying the infrared behavior of black holes, the long time behavior of black holes, turns into ultra high energy behavior near the horizon. This development of chaos is one aspect of that late time high energy correspondence. Yes?
So, coming in from the physics of things, but so earlier when you were injecting the W,
yeah.
The time when you were going back in time,
yeah. Yeah.
Energy,
yeah.
But then I would expect it to start with lots of energy because of that.
Yeah.
But now you're saying it starts with thermal energy and then it increases in time forward.
But yeah, I've got, I mean, the point is, if it's got like thermal energy very late here, the collision is when it's going at high energy. The collision is when it's very close to the horizon, back after it got blue shifted. Okay. The collision takes place much earlier than the final time you pull the quanta out. I agree this is a little confusing, but okay. So delta, the phase shift, if we do perturbation theory, so we assume that G Newton S is pretty small, so we just have to keep one graviton exchange, we found that this is proportional to G Newton S, which is like using the holographic correspondence, 1 over n squared, where n is the n of super Yang Mills. And this is T squared e to the 2 pi t over beta. This is dimensionless, and you make the dimensions up by some LADS squared. So you find that this out of time order correlator goes like some constant at the beginning minus some other constant. I'm lying to you in the service of a greater truth right now. T squared over n squared e to the 2 pi t over beta. Well, this is just the behavior that I was advertising if we identify the Lyapunov exponent as 2 pi over beta, which you can write as 2 pi times temperature. Lyapunov has dimensions of inverse time. It's a ring. This is the Einstein gravity formula for the Lyapunov exponent, a precise calculation because we have a precise definition that we can precisely compute holographically. We can ask now, when does this become order one? So this is this behavior where you start off at C naught. I won't specify what C naught is. We know it's like VVWW. It starts breaking away. We can ask when this breakaway is appreciable. When this thing becomes order one, it breaks away when T star is the order of beta over 2 pi log n squared, which we can write as beta over 2 pi log s. This is a precise calculation in Einstein gravity, or at large a TUF coupling in the Super-Yang-Mills theory of the scrambling time. In particular, this coefficient is now precise. Well, I've got 15 minutes left, and I'm on page 9 of 20. So we'll engage in some packet dropping now. Let's talk about some of the things we need to do to make a more complete story. When G Newton S is of order 1, we can't just keep the tree level exchange. We really should keep a whole bunch of exchanges like this, and maybe a cross ladder. If G Newton S is order 1, but G Newton is still small in ADS units or something, we can ignore diagrams like this. This is called an H diagram, and so on. One can sum up all these ladders and cross ladders by the Iconal approximation. This means for every power of the coupling constant, you get a high energy, because these lines are moving at high energy. And this, it's well known in ordinary quantum field theory and was first applied to gravity by a Tuft, that the way you do this is you imagine scattering a V particle, or a V quanta, off of the classical gravitational field created by a highly boosted W of T. So you can go beyond this tree-level exchange by figuring out the classical field produced by a very fast-moving, a highly boosted W particle. And this metric has been worked out. It was worked out in flat space gravity by Eichelberg and Sexel a long time ago. But it can be worked out in the ADS-Schwarzschild black hole by Tuft and Dre in the flat space black hole, and by Svetsos and Daniel Douglas Stanford in the ADS-Schwarzschild black hole. And the picture you get is a geometry. I won't write formulas because I'm short of time. You get a geometry that's called a shockwave geometry. In some sort of unofficial Penrose diagram, this W operator late sources a delta function concentrated pulse of gravitational radiation running right along the horizon. It only has kind of thermal scale invariant energy, so there are no invariant curvatures that are large. But it's highly boosted. And the effect of this geometry is if you shoot some other kind of quanta across it, physically you have a highly boosted particle. All it does is it wallops the particle and displaces it by a certain displacement in this direction. It's usually best to think about this in crustal coordinates, where that's u and that's v. This thing is at u equals 0. That's where the shock wave lives. The effect of this is a displacement delta v that's proportional to h, it's usually called. This geometry can be written down. Again, because it's made of these kinds of diagrams, it's easy to write down because it doesn't involve any of the real nonlinearities of gravity. It's essentially a linearized solution, although it can be written in a way that hides that fact. Okay.
This is a geodesic, for example, in this geometry?
Say it's a geodesic, yeah, you can think of it as a geodesic, yeah. And if I ignore the transverse dependence, imagine that the pulse is smeared in the transverse directions, h is proportional to 1 over n squared e to the 2 pi t over beta. So here we're not just doing tree level exchange, but we see the effect when t gets bigger and bigger of a bigger and bigger null displacement. So now we're in a position where we have geometrized the effect of chaos. So we can try to understand some of these scattering things in a geometrical way. So one thing one can do is you can try to study this slightly different OTO correlator, out of time order correlator, of the time I talked about a little while ago. You can imagine putting an operator on the left, an operator on the right, and two W's. These two W's make this shock wave, and then you have an operator, let's say at time 0, on the left, and an operator the right. And imagine that you're in ADS3, where you can compute correlators efficiently of heavy particles. Let's say the bulk mass of this thing is m, which is large compared to ADS mass. And so its conformal dimension, which is like ML, is much greater than 1. You can compute this correlation function in the presence of the shock by finding the geodesic connecting these two points. But the geodesic is easy to compute. This geometry is basically, it's not basically, it's precisely two pieces of ADS Schwarzschild glued together by a null shift of this amount. So you take two pieces of the geometry and just glue them together with the appropriate boundary condition here. And all the boundary condition does is make geodesics move by that null shift. And there is some stress energy. There's a delta function of stress energy. But the entire effect is to make this null shift. So then you can try to find the geodesic connecting these two points. Without the shock wave, the geodesic would measure the length of the wormhole, which we know, you know, something like that. If you take out the UV infinities, it's a length of order thermal or ADS length. It tells you that the wormhole is short. This goes back to the original ideas of Mark Van Romsdonk and Maldacena, that the short wormhole is an expression of a high local entanglement, special local entanglements between the left and the right copies of the thermal field double. Entanglement is geometry. Well, this shock wave changes the geometry, and in fact, you compute the length of this geodesic. Well, you find the geodesic from here to some point on the shock, this point. Here you find the geodesic from some point here, and you require these two endpoints be separated by the null shift. And so then you solve the problem. If you require these two points to be separated by h, move these up and down to minimize the length. You solve that problem. That's actually solved in this first paper. This is the way we did it. And you find the length of the geodesic goes like when you subtract out this UV infinity, that these geodesics are secretly infinite length, is so this is regulated. Is 2 times LADS times log 1 plus this shift over 2. Not dimensionally, this shift is measured in some ADS units. And remember, this shift grows exponentially in time. So as the time gets very long, the geodesic gets very long. In fact, it grows linearly in time. So as you apply this shock earlier and earlier, you make the wormhole longer and longer. You've disrupted the special local entanglements between the left and the right side. Chaos, the thermofield double state is a very special state. Chaos applied to one side, an operator on one side, touches off chaotic development, which changes these special local entanglements. This is an idea first that motivated us in the first place. And the geometric signature of that, that's a lot of the theme of this conference, you can geometrize these quantum information notions, is that the wormhole gets long. And then you can calculate this correlation function, V left, V right, in the presence of the shock, if you'll use that abusive notation, goes like e to the minus the mass times the length of the geodesic. That's the geodesic approximation. That goes like 1 over 1 plus 1 over m squared e to the 2 pi t over beta raised to the 2ml, that's the conformal dimension of these V operators. And there's some constants that I'll align. You see that for short times, this is 1, because n squared is a big number. It breaks away 1 minus 1 over n squared e to the 2 pi t over beta, plus some number, depending on delta. So this breakaway is universal with this exponential rate, independent of delta, except for this prefactor. This is the fact that gravitational scattering is universal. It doesn't matter what kind of quanta V is made out of, or W for that. But then, at very large time, it saturates and has an exponential decay that goes like e to the minus 2 pi t over beta times delta, or 2 delta. So the thing decays away in a way that depends, that's not universal. And this is due to a phenomenon that I haven't explained very well. It's the fact, or I haven't tried to explain, it's that if you go to very long times, the energy of this collision is enormous. 2 scrambling times is enough energy to make a macroscopic black hole, okay, to fill up an ADS volume. Why doesn't this chaos go crazy? Why don't this function just fall apart? We actually worried about this quite a bit. It took us close to a year to understand this. The reason is that in this overlap of out and in, such an inelastic process would make a very small contribution to this. You look for the rare processes where that matrix element is not so small. You have these operators that actually create a wide variety of bulk quanta described by a boundary to bulk propagator. So you have to smear the scattering element against a bunch of boundary to bulk propagators. The thing that makes the biggest contribution at late time is the rare part of these boundary to bulk propagators that does not create a high energy collision. You're looking for the amplitude for things not to happen. And there's a small tail in these wave functions described by quasi-normal modes that is this phenomenon. So I was disappointed. In some sense, the most interesting thing in quantum gravity would be these big collisions, but these simple operators don't diagnose this. They make a small contribution. So this is an example of the kind of curve we expect for this out-of-time order correlator. Well, I have 1 minute left. And in that 1 minute, let me just say that formulating these diagnostics in terms of correlation functions, which is a language where you have a lot of power that we've developed over the years in thinking about quantum mechanics and quantum field theory, allows us to make precise statements that do not depend on holography. And so in particular, we were able to use the fact that these out-of-time order correlators are analytic in time, as correlation functions are, to prove a very general bound with Maldacena, saying that in a system with a large number of degrees of freedom, n squared large, and another technical assumption that is the analog of k-locality, basically that the scrambling time is long compared to these relaxation times that you see early, plus that this Lyapunov exponent, the rate of exponential decay, is less than or equal to 2 pi over beta, plus order 1 over n squared. In any thermal quantum system, this is the Einstein gravity value. This is a numerically precise refinement of the fast scrambling conjecture, which says this log entropy is the fastest that you can scramble anything. So fast scrambling conjecture would say lambda L is less than or equal to infinity. There's no faster growth than exponential. That's the fast scrambling conjecture. But furthermore, this is very much in the spirit of a famous conjecture still unproven that the viscosity to entropy ratio is less than or equal to 1 over 4 pi due to Covton, Sternetz, and Song. A numerically precise value determined by black holes that bounds the behavior of thermal quantum systems. Translated into a scattering time, this means that thermal quanta can scatter no faster. So this must be, the scattering time must be longer than a characteristic time, h bar over k Boltzmann times temperature, with a numerical coefficient depending on pi's. The Lyapunov exponent is an inverse time. It's kind of the time for trajectories to diverge. This time, of course, is also something like 1 over this strong coupling time. So both of these are evidence that the fastest possible times in strongly coupled thermal systems, things can scatter no faster in this time. This time, I don't think, has a name. It should be called, some people call it the Planck time. Planck time has another meaning for us. Some people call it the Boltzmann time. That seems deeply unfair. So it needs, this should have a name, but I don't know what it is. But so this is just one of the other outputs of formulating these sharp signatures and allowing one to study. In closing, I'll say, though, although I think we have quite a precise understanding of this phenomenon, it is just the tip of the iceberg of the quantum theory of chaotic development. The bulk description I gave you was perturbative quantum gravity. There, it turns out that there are perturbative string corrections that I have not been able to discuss. But we're not making macroscopic black holes. Quantum gravity has not broken down. This very interesting strong coupling behavior in the boundary theory is rather simple bulk dynamics. The things I talked about in this discussion section of long-time behavior and the dissolving of two-point functions into oscillations, my own view is that is a signature of real breakdown of perturbative quantum gravity. And I think that's a very interesting direction to go in this interface between quantum gravity and quantum chaos. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
For a few questions. Rosie?
It is making highly plausible physical assumptions. Basically, the time-ordered correlators decay in the way that I said. There is a precise mathematical argument establishing this. So it is not a conjecture. Okay? It is what I would call a physicist proof, making something that we all believe to be true, that time-ordered correlators relax. It is not. The argument here does not depend on holography at all. It is a statement that uses quantum mechanics, analyticity of correlation functions, and unitarity. There is no hint of holography. Holography was just a motivation. Sorry? Say that again? Large N. Yeah, large N, but that is in large N, it could be a completely non-holographic system. Large N enters assuming some kind of, well, it can be more general, but particular assuming large N factorization. So this would apply to any large N theory that obeys large N factorization and even more. Holography is only a motivation. There's no holographic technique used at all. It turns out the holographic bound is established. So this is one of these happy places where something motivated by holography can be proved by very general quantum mechanical techniques. Yes. No, I mean, the short statement is no. The short answer is no. The reason is integrability applies to states whose energies are order one. We are now in a high energy situation where the typical states have energy n squared, where the system is not integrable. Integrability basically implies that quanta don't scatter. It's a statement about the behavior of the free theory. This has got lots of interactions. The only way in which it enters in is in the following. There is a way, as you know, to relate a vacuum behavior to something that looks like a thermal system by the Rindler space construction. You can take the Minkowski vacuum, and in a different coordinate system, it looks thermal. So you can repeat this analysis in ADS Rindler, and then it turns out that the Lyapunov exponent is related to something controlled by integrability, the Regge intercept, which can be calculated exactly as a function of a Tuft lambda. So you then can compute in ADS Rindler, in a horrible notational conflict, lambda L as a function of a Tuft lambda. This curve is known by integrability techniques for ADS Riddler. In general, this bound actually has power in computing things about zero temperature conformal field theory. It constrains first sheet data to quantities when you continue onto the second sheet of the four-point function.
So I understand you're computing only these rare elastic processes at high energy.
Yes.
But even so, won't there be a breakdown of the economic approximation of sufficiently high invariant energy? To the point of estimating
we actually think that things continue to be small. Basically, a breakdown, which would consist of some, let's say, some black hole formation, is almost always inelastic, which makes that matrix element smaller. So that what you do instead is you dig deeper into the wave function and you focus on a lower energy process by trading in for a smaller part of the wave function. Because then you have less inelastic things going on. So basically, the bulk quanta, if this is more or less a point in the boundary, it creates a whole family of different bulk energies. Okay, it's smeared by this bulk to boundary propagator, which has a very smooth profile. Okay, so you're folding this S matrix element against the smooth family of various momenta and energy. Okay, so why pay the price for some very small inelastic matrix element when you could go deeper into the tail and get a nice large elastic process? So you're balancing that to get the largest contribution. Okay, and that's what gives this tail. This is digging deep into the tail of that bulk to boundary wave function. There are special circumstances where we think we can isolate some of the higher energy processes. For instance, string production turns out to make the largest contribution to, let's say, the commutator squared for some cancellation reasons. So by looking carefully, we can dig out and see some inelastic processes. But if you're not careful like that, we think it will make systematically subleading contributions, even for very late time.
I'm going to suggest that we take the rest of the questions offline. Let's thank Steve again.